Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Ranks FC. This is your favourite football podcast. We're doing things a little bit differently this week with the return of the Champions League and, of course, the Champions League existing over 3 days for the first time ever. We're going to be just splitting our episodes up a little bit more this week. This is Champions League Takeaway, the first episode of the season. Those of you who've been with us a long time will know that over the last couple of seasons, we've done a Champions League Takeaway extra episode on a Wednesday night after the games that's come out straight after them with our reaction live to everything that's gone on in the Champions League over the course of the week. This week, with it being over 3 days, we thought we would do it twice. It was so nice. We had to do it twice, and we're going to be back on Thursday talking about the games on Wednesday and Thursday. That'll go out first or late night on Thursday night, and then, of course, there'll be a truth on Friday morning. So loads of content for you on the channel this week. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today, and joining me across the water, watching the Champions League for the first time on Pacific time, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, what a day I've had. Yeah, recording this at 2 p.m, and I've seen all the Champions League stuff and a little bit of Carabao Cup action along the way too. So yeah, it's been a busy day while the kids have been off at school. Quite nice in a way. Can do other bits of work while I'm watching the games, make some notes on what I'm seeing. Yeah, I've enjoyed it, mate. The day has barely begun, yet we've seen a lot.
We have seen a lot. It's been a wild first night in many ways of the new Champions League format. This show is going to be split into two parts. We're going to do three games in each part. And then on Thursday's show, we'll do a segment each looking at Wednesday's and Thursday's games. So a little bit more of a deep dive, I suppose, on tonight's ones. And with them being the first games of this new format, I thought it was only fitting that we gave it the love and respect it deserves. And also, it's the only thing everyone's going to be talking about on a Wednesday morning. So we thought we would get in on the conversation as well. Dean, you're going to take two of these games and I'm going to try and work us through the rest of them. And we're going to start this first segment off by talking about AC Milan 1, Liverpool 3 at San Siro. It was a little bit uncomfortable for Liverpool after the weekend that they had. We knew that Milan had been a bit all over the place, but a good win for Paolo Fonseca's men at the weekend over Venezia. So when Milan took the lead in this one, I was a little bit wary of what everything might look like, but Liverpool pulled through.
Well, when Liverpool play against AC Milan, they have to force a comeback, right? It wouldn't be right if they didn't. And Arne Slot knows his history, mate. He knows how to get these fans on board. You go to play AC Milan in Europe, you gotta have a bit of a narrative to it. So he let them go 1-0 up early doors and thought, yep, I can get on board with the past here at Liverpool. And he did exactly that. Look, I've got three takeaways. The score, in case you don't know, ended up AC Milan 1, Liverpool 3. The big takeaway, really, in terms of how the game ended up the way it did, came down to set pieces. We're seeing a lot about set pieces at the moment. Obviously, in the Premier League, there was all the Tottenham stuff at the weekend, and there's a lot of talk about all the teams that are taking on set piece coaches. And after Liverpool fall behind here, go 1-0 down, don't play very well, to be honest, in the opening stages of this game, and it looks a little bit worrying. But they survived that poor start, and Milan allowed them to do that. First one comes from a free kick. Trent, it's like a pitching wedge, really, the cross. He's like, he kind of manages to get the ball up and down, and Konate heads it in from very close range. Now, you cannot give Konate or Van Dijk any space to allow them to get above you or have any run and jump on you, right? If you're defending against Liverpool from a set piece. But not only did AC Milan do it once, but they did it twice. Konate was first to head home from that free kick. And then for Liverpool to go in front, they score from a second. A corner comes in. Van Dijk's like, what, 3 yards out? Should not be allowed to head it from the position that he's standing in. Nods it in. It's one of the most basic things I've ever seen in Champions League football. And unfortunately, I have to point the finger of blame at the goalkeeper. Mike Maignan is rooted to his spot on both occasions. And it's pretty disappointing. He didn't have a particularly bad game overall. I mean, it was a bad day for him because he ends up actually being substituted after the break, Magnon. And they end up having to bring on a 19-year-old goalkeeper, Lorenzo Torriani, for his into a Champions League cauldron against Liverpool, which you don't want. Magnon leaves the pitch in the second half with his head buried in his shirt. Actually, just after he'd made a very good save, to be fair, from Jota. But I'm afraid, as far as I can see it, Magnon is to blame for the fact that Liverpool were able to turn the game on its head and put themselves in command. So, yeah, very basic stuff, really, mate. And you can't be doing that from an AC Milan perspective in the Champions League against one of the best teams in the Champions League. So that made things more difficult for them. I'll go straight on to point two, which, to be honest, is that Milan stars often don't all turn up, right, on the same night. And Pulisic did. I don't feel like any of his supporting cast really did enough. Pulisic did score the opening goal in this game. So well done, American superstar Christian Pulisic. It's 3 goals in 5 games now for him this season. It was a poor moment from Liverpool. Tsimikas is caught out of position. Liverpool can't cover the gap that he's left. Milan absolutely exposed that problem that they've had open up. It's a very easy goal in the end. But Pulisic, to be fair, still has a lot of work to do and does really well to bury it. It was a show of how vulnerable this Liverpool team can be on the turn. But let's focus for a second just on the positives of Pulisic. It was his 30th goal contributions in all competitions for AC Milan. 18 goals now and 12 assists for him. No player, Jack, has contributed to more goals for a Serie A team than Pulisic since he joined Milan, which is a really interesting stat. Mm. This is a guy, obviously, that's been desperate to find himself a home, desperate to find himself somewhere to properly live up to his potential. And it's looking like Pulisic does have that home now in Milan. It's his 9th Champions League goal. And it's just a really good sign of promise for Christian Pulisic. As I say, I feel like he was a bit let down on the night. There were not enough big performances from AC Milan, and they end up going from an early 1-0 lead to lose the game 3-1. It wasn't good enough. Liao almost scored right at the death to kind of give them something to hang on to, but again, just didn't manage to get it in. So Liao continues, I guess, to flatter to deceive, if you like. I mean, he's an unbelievable footballer, and you get moments from Liao like the other day in Serie A when he produces that outrageous assist, pass for the assist, I guess, but it's an outrageous pass that Liao comes out with the other day, like a pirouette. Back flick or something. I don't know. Unbelievable. But yeah, there was none of that here, mate. And I guess just to leave you on this one with something, it's that Liverpool have got this Champions League pedigree already. But there were 3 displays from Liverpool players that really stood out for me for different reasons. And it was Szoboszlai, Gravenberch and Cody Gakpo. Cody Gakpo doesn't get his name on the score sheet, but it was a really good performance from him. And we know he's capable of big, big performances. And I think this one of the best ones I've seen in a big game from him. He was really involved in a lot of the good stuff that Liverpool managed to put together. And he comes out of it with his head held high and knowing that he has a lot to play in the coming weeks and months for Liverpool as they try to figure out exactly what their best version of this team is going to be. Now, Gravenberch and Szoboszlai gives them something different. Gravenberch is kind of fixing this problem that they were left with when they failed to sign Zubimendi, right? So that was a big disappointment for them. There was a sign there for 2 or 3 days that they were going to get Zubimendi, and then it doesn't happen. He doesn't want to rattle things at Real Sociedad or whatever it ends up happening. He doesn't leave. And Liverpool are left with a problem because they decide, actually, we're not going to just rush out and sign anyone now. We're not just going to sign someone for the sake of it. And so they need somebody to fill this void. And Gravenberch, not really a natural DM, if you like. really starting to find his feet in this role, mate. I thought he had a really good game. There was one moment in particular around the 70-minute mark when I think it's Konate gets tied up in knots down the flank. I think it's Liao. And there's a great recovery from Gravenberch as he comes in and makes a great block as he's trying to switch it back in across the six-yard box, which could easily have led to AC Milan getting back into the game at a dangerous time. So full credit to Gravenberch for the way that he is helping Liverpool through that problematic area. And as for Szoboszlai, well, this was a big game for him. He's got a Champions League goal now for Liverpool. We know he's got Champions League pedigree already from his past clubs. This was his eighth goal, I think, in 26 Champions League games. It's a really nice goal from Liverpool, the way that it all builds up. It's a counter-attack. Actually, I think it was Gravenberch that started things off with a really nice ball out from deep. And it goes out to Gakpo, and it's Szoboszlai that ends up guiding the ball in off the far post. It's a crucial moment, and these are the moments you want to see more of from Szoboszlai. And these are the moments you're expecting to see more of from this guy, and I think we will be seeing more of. I have to be honest, like till that moment, like it was feeling a bit fragile for Liverpool. Like it was a good performance, and it was 2-1, and it deserved to be 2-1 because they came through those early stages that I talked about. But they needed that third goal. They really did. So a big takeaway for me is that those three players are going to be key, because I do think that, I don't think you consider Liverpool as favourites as such for a Champions League, but they're kind of in between being a favourite and a dark horse. They should be in that favourites category because of the amount of times they've actually managed to do it. But given the transition they're in, changing managers, where they've been at over the past year or so, they're kind of on the cusp of being a favourite, right? So I think that they've shown traits here that show that they will be one of the better teams in this competition.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting actually thinking about that as a kind of more general topic. And I'm sure over the weeks and months to come, we'll have more discussions about the Champions League format. We're going to got to let it see it play out first and before we really make any snap judgments on it. But there is this kind of weird sense. And I think, you know, having talked to people tonight, there is a sense that people are a bit confused, I suppose, about what this was and what the games tonight felt like. And they were like, a lot of them feel like training exercises. Now, this might not have been the point with this Milan-Liverpool game, which was kind of the big fixture of the first day, right? Obviously, rerun of the 2005 final, 2007 final. It has a lot of pedigree in it as a game. But there was this kind of sense of like, what's the jeopardy? Because if you've got eight games and you lose the first one, you win your next seven, you're absolutely fine. So there is that kind of sense of, we're not quite sure how important everything is yet. And I think what that means is that outside of Real Madrid and Manchester City, who have been the two dominant sides, I think, across Europe, and most people would agree with that, there are other contenders. I think that Inter probably should be in that conversation. But for the vast majority of people, I think the sense is that almost UEFA are trying to engineer a Manchester City versus Real Madrid final here. And there is also a sense that over the last two seasons, at the very least, maybe three, those games between Manchester City and Real Madrid have felt like they've determined the outcome of the Champions League without actually being played in the final. And I think that's an interesting thing to consider. So outside of those two, you kind of look at this group underneath them of other favourites. And I think that includes everyone else who you'd expect to be, you know, in that conversation. I think Liverpool are probably in that conversation. I think Bayern are in that conversation. PSG are in that conversation. Inter are in that conversation. And then there's a couple of sort of more wild cards. And maybe Liverpool living at Arsenal are in that conversation as well, I think, in terms of having, you know, what is such a brilliant defensive record. But there's not loads of teams and that are kind of set as that second generation of challengers. And I think that you look at Barcelona, who are obviously in a bit of, well, tumult is the wrong word because they've started the season so well, but they're in a bit of a transition period. Juventus in a bit of a transition period, and Liverpool are also in that. But the way that they've started the season probably suggests differently. So it's interesting kind of trying to work out exactly where everyone would be. And one of my friends, one of the friends of this podcast, texted me earlier saying, who are the top eight going to be? No idea, mate. Absolutely not a clue. So it's intriguing to kind of think of it as where the kind of tiers of contenders live right now.
Yeah, but I think one thing we do know from kind of what the insights that experts have been giving on what we should expect from this format of the competition is that it, to make the top eight of this Champions League table, you probably need 15 points, right? So that's that seems to be the general consensus.
Minimum, I think. I think 17 pretty much guarantees you it.
You want to get to five wins, basically. Like five wins as quick as you can, right? To give you like, basically, you're basically through at that point. So that's, I think, all you can really look for at this stage. Like, as one of the favourites, how quickly can you get those five wins on the board? And that's really all Liverpool need to take from a game like this. One of the trickier fixtures for sure of this opening day, this opening week. But they've come through it, especially a bit of adversity at the beginning of the game, and the first win's ticked off.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first win ticked off also for Bayern Munich in
only
some
just.
Style. Some style. I mean, Bayern won 9-2 against Dinamo Zagreb at the Allianz in Munich. And my first thought about this, Dean, was that it was like a perfect three-act story arc. Good to see like the scripting gods are still on the basics. The first half was so easy for Bayern. They were 3-0 up at halftime that this threatened to kind of drop into obscurity. And so they conceded twice in 5 minutes at the start of the second half to give it some climax and conflict before they just sort of got their heads back on the pitch, resolved the issue, scored twice in quick succession, and then added four more for good measure. So you kind of look at this and think, what a strange game, because at 3-2 on the 50th minute mark, okay, maybe it was probably a bit of a stretch to say Zagreb are right back in this, but they would have thought, well, hang on, we were 3-0 down, it's now 3-2, we've got 40 minutes to play in this one. And then fast forward 40 minutes and they've lost 9-2, which is the biggest or the highest total score in Champions League history in a single game. Mm. So it's gone from being like, oh, a Bayern on the edge of collapsing. I tweeted at the time, I was like, hang on, something's happening in Munich, eyes on. And then the next thing you know, they've dropped a record score. So, I mean,
well, you go, something did happen.
I wasn't wrong, but it wasn't for the reasons that I thought it was going to be. Suddenly I thought that there was a game coming on here. And to be honest, the way that Zagreb came out at the start of the second half and the way that they started to get into those positions, Petkovic scores the first. It's a really nice little play through for the second as well. And you're thinking, okay, this Bayern back line all of a sudden looks all over the place. Upamecano is wandering around in midfield. It was a bit of a strange lineup in some ways from Wim Van Zandt company as well, because there wasn't quite, we weren't quite sure exactly what it looked like. It turned out there was Rafael Guerreiro in midfield, but at first they were like, are Bayern playing five at the back? Is Guerreiro playing sort of left center back? Is Afonso Davis playing left center back? Everyone was a bit confused about what it looked like. I mean, the first half, there was such feeble opposition from a Zagreb perspective, that Bayern waltzed into a 3-0 lead. They had a couple more chalked off for offside, and that continued through the entire game. I mean, I think Bayern put the ball in the back of the net 11 times tonight, and that's really quite saying something. But this real sense about Bayern that, you know, we were talking about them on 5x5 last week, we've talked about them in a variety of ways, that they have not yet beaten anyone that you wouldn't expect Bayern to be beating, even last season where they weren't at their very best. And there were games where they dropped points to teams that they would have expected to beat. But generally, you kind of look at their fixtures so far, their results so far, and you're thinking, okay, we're still yet to see you have a test. There was a test here because they had that moment where they thought they might implode. And watching that, and obviously Manuel Neuer goes off at halftime because he gets a head injury, and Sven Ulreich comes on, and 5 minutes later they've conceded twice after being in complete control of this game. And you're thinking, oh no. And look, I think a team with a weaker mentality, and also this, you know, props to Van Zandt company here, because when you're looking at this, you're thinking, well, what did he take over in the summer? He took over a team that were probably pretty shell-shocked from not just not winning the Bundesliga last year, but not winning anything, and not just coming second, but coming third in the Bundesliga and actually succumbing to Stuttgart on the later kind of days of the season. So when you're putting all that together, you can imagine that there could be a fragility around the Bayern mentality, that as soon as things started to not go their way, then maybe it wouldn't work out. But that clearly doesn't seem to be the case. Now, again, they will come up against tougher opposition than Dinamo Zagreb over the next couple of weeks. And even Dinamo Zagreb at the Maximir are a different proposition to what they are away from home. This was not anything like any of the Dinamo Zagreb that we've caught bits of over the start of this season. Martin Baturina, who's the heir to Luka Modric in many ways, in inverted commas, and is very much the kind of crown jewel of Croatian football, I think, right now. Really didn't get on the ball, had no chance to influence proceedings here. Bayern completely and utterly had this by the scruff of the neck for 85 minutes of the game. But the fact that they did have to deal with that sort of mild inconvenience of conceding twice in quick succession, and obviously the Dinamo fans going absolutely mad in the corner with the big banners, and there was a lot that travelled. So a fair play to for them for making the journey. But, you know, I think that what we've learned from Bayern tonight, and perhaps, you know, takeaways here, and are actually just that this mentality has started to influence the side, and that if there were questions about what Kompany's influence has been and the culture that he's tried to bring back to the club, some of those things were answered, I think, this evening.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? They kind of have to just set their own standards by Munich for each game and just set their own aims and objectives and complete them, basically. I mean, Holstein Kiel last weekend, obviously expected to be battered. They go and do it. Today, I mean, I wasn't expecting a scoreline to that extent, but obviously it's a fixture you're expected to win by a clear amount of goals, and they've gone above and beyond the game to do it.
But also, goal difference could be important. It's something we didn't really mention, but goal difference actually may well come into play here, because there are probably going to be quite a lot of teams on the same kind of points when it comes to the end of it. And you know what? That seven goals in the opening day might be the difference between finishing eighth or ninth. Now, it might not be for Bayern, but for certain teams, I think that actually finishing in those spaces, or, you know, the difference between finishing three places higher up in the seeding system, this is all going to matter in the long term. And that's the good thing about the seeding system. You can have your problems with it, but the good thing means that there is more riding on this group stage than perhaps would have been if it was just a straight kind of draw afterwards for the teams that fit in certain positions.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I haven't actually seen this 9-2 win yet, but the one thing that jumps out at me, Jack, is that Harry Kane scored three penalties. A hat-trick of penalties is a pretty rare thing in football. I don't know if I've ever seen the same player score three penalties in a game. Usually, actually, you'd end up passing one of them over, right? But Harry Kane is an absolute goal monster at this stage. He's like, absolutely, I'm getting that golden boot again this season. In fact, I'm going to, you know, Mbappe might have gone to Real Madrid, whatever. Haaland might be doing his thing at Man City. I'm going to outscore you all. And he's bagged a hat-trick at the weekend for today. But, mate, three penalties is, like, unreal. Like, I don't think I've seen it.
Do you know what's really funny in that it didn't, until you just mentioned it, obviously I knew that he scored three penalties, but it hadn't really registered in my head. I think it's because, obviously, he scored a goal from open play as well, so it wasn't the hat-trick goal. But also, there were so many goals going in left, right, and centre that you kind of forgot about it. The other thing is that Elise had just gone off. And I do think that if Michael Olise had still been on the pitch, then Harry Kane might have given him the ball for that to complete his own hat trick, because he was on a hat trick himself at that point. But he'd been substituted. So Kane was like, fine then, I guess I'll score again. I like that he put his first two penalties to the same place and then switched the third one up.
Did he do that? Yeah, because that's what I was thinking. I was like, what would you do with the third one? Because it's quite typical that a player like Harry Kane would stick two in the same spot, one after the other. But for the third one,
well, he started to step a lot of it, you know. It was keeper moving before he actually hit the ball. So, you know, credit where it's due. Harry Kane was excellent. To be honest, the entire Bayern attack was excellent. And I know that's easy to say after they put nine goals past an opposition. So, like, you know, without excusing the cliche on it, just the way that it moved together. And I think this is almost the perfect night for Kompany, because not only did he have to watch his side, as we say, go through a little bit of turmoil, but also there's the element of who's scoring the big ones. You know, they're actually kind of looking at this and thinking, well, Michael Olise is off the mark in the Champions League after scoring his first Bayern goal at the weekend. Leroy Sané comes on and scores a big goal at the end. Goretzka, whose future's been up in the air and who, you know, Kompany's had to go out and defend over the last week. Yeah, he comes on and scores. Big moments. He gets to celebrate in front of the Bayern fans, you know, punches the badge, goes, I'm not going anywhere. These are all big moments for Bayern. They got to rotate a lot of players in and out. You got to see those changes being made. At least they get off the mark in the Champions League. Kane is absolutely firing them in. That's seven in his last two, as you point out. I think that's about as good as you could ask for if you're Vincent Kompany. And look, but like we say, we can't really, I think, make any concrete evidence decisions on Bayern until we see them play more difficult opposition. But you can only beat what's in front of you. And right now they're beating what's in front of them very, very comfortably.
So far, so good, Bayern Munich.
Yeah, and it's a bit different to when they won their first pre-season game against Rotak Eggen, 14-1.
Well, it didn't actually feel that different, I'll be honest.
But it is different. It's a Champions League. This is a pre-season game. You're not supposed to get these scorelines.
Yes, absolutely. Right, before we go to a break, I just wanted to quickly touch on Sporting against Lille. It was 2-0 to Sporting, and the first thing I've got to say to you is that if you do anything from this entire day of football, go back and watch the second goal that Sporting score here. It's from Zeno de Bast, who's the right centre back in Ruben Amorim's three at the back. I think it's the best goal I've seen in a long, long time. It is an absolute thumper. He has no right to hit it. Zeno de Bast is not a big goal scorer. He's not a big goal scoring guy. He's a Belgian centre back. And this ball comes to him about 35 yards out. And he wallops it across the ball, top corner. It is just one of the best things you'll see all this year. And to be honest, the bar is set very high for the Champions League goal of the season already. This is right up there. But look, Sporting completely and utterly in control of this game from pretty much the moment it kicked off. There are a couple of early opportunities for Lille in this one. But generally, as soon as they went 1-0 up and 2 minutes later, Angel Gomes was sent off, there was one team in this. I don't think Lille had a shot on target after that. And Sporting are very quietly going about their business. This team know exactly what to do. This system is so set in stone for Amorim that he knows exactly how to get the best out of all of these players. We're seeing rotation. Quenda and Katamo's wingbacks, they were absolutely sensational. They didn't look bothered at all. The back three, De Bast, Diamande, and Anasio, dealing with someone as good as Jonathan David. Kjellman and Morita were completely dominant in the center. And then up top, Victor Gyökeres' first goal here is sublime. And his goal scoring record continues to go from strength to strength. But the fact that nobody took a gamble on Gyökeres before Sporting did continues to amaze me. The way that he gets this ball, it comes to him. He's got his back to goal. He's sort of wide of the 6 yard box. He drives back, takes a touch, flicks it out of his feet, and then just hammers it into the bottom corner. Keeper, absolutely no chance. It is a real pure striker's goal. And with him up top, honestly, I think Sporting can go really far in this competition. I've said it before that I think that they're going to be comfortable in terms of where the Primera is. And we talked about them on Monday's post-box where I was discussing their win at the weekend over Arouca. But the fact that they're able to make these rotations in midfield, the fact that they were able to bring, you know, these players off later in the game and bring in some youngsters, Daniel Braganza still getting real good minutes in here, Comrade Harder as well. But generally, the way that they're playing, the kind of knowledge and depth that this system has under Amorim. Obviously, it looked like he was going to leave in the summer. He decided not to. It feels like they've had a massive, massive lift around the club again, and they were already the best team in Portugal. But I wonder if this is the year that they can make a statement on the European stage. And I'm not saying they're going to win it, but I do think that this Sporting side have enough, and they've got home games against Arsenal and Manchester City in this league stage. That is not going to be an easy place to go for anybody this season. And I'm really intrigued to see what they can do against some of the bigger boys.
Interesting, interesting one. We'll look out for that one, mate.
And just one point on Lille. I'm really, really deeply unsure about this five at the back formation, and I don't understand it. Now, they've had an okay start to the season under Bruno Genesio, who obviously replaced Paulo Fonseca, who's gone off to Milan. Genesio with Ren over the last sort of year and a half, you know, he took that job. He started in 2021. I think he finished in 2023 in sort of November. So almost a year ago now. And he had a couple of months off. For pretty much the entire time he was at Ren, he played with four at the back. Last season in this Lille team, Fonseca played with four at the back. And Genesio has gone in here. And bear in mind, the only player they really lost over the summer in terms of regular first team minutes was Leny Yoro, who obviously joined Manchester United for a big fee. Yusuf Djihadji went off, but I think it was time for him to go at this point. He's starting to be phased out of the team. So a lot of this team is very similar to last year, where they did really well. Clearly, they're in the Champions League. I have no idea why they have switched to a five at the back formation. I don't think it gets the best out of almost any of their players. And I think that if Lille continue on this path, they're going to struggle this season, because even before the sending off, which they can be duly a little bit, I think upset's the wrong word. They can be a bit frustrated by it, because it was two yellow card offenses in quick succession. The second one is quite accidental, though it probably is a yellow card. You can understand them being a bit frustrated by that. But just on the whole, I just don't feel like they have any control of games anymore. Genesio is a different manager to Fonseca, and that's fine.
But this five at the back formation, I can't see them doing any favors. And the fact that they've had a pretty indifferent start to the season, I think already speaks to that. So Lee a bit all over the place. I'm not really enjoying what's going on there, but Sporting are the absolute business.
Lovely stuff, mate. Lovely stuff. Good wrap.
All right, we'll take a break there. And after the break, we're going to be talking about Real Madrid. We're going to be talking about Aston Villa and Thiago Motta's new look Juventus. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC, where we're working through all of Tuesday's Champions League games. Dean, I'll let you start on the last one, but I feel like I'm going to take the lead on the second half of things. And we're going to talk a little bit about Real Madrid 3, Stuttgart 1. Now, nothing particularly takes your eye about that scoreline. That's the kind of thing you would expect off this Real Madrid side, especially at home at the Bernabeu. But Dean, I'm telling you, this was an episode of rewind the tape. Real Madrid, second best for long periods. Courtois making excellent saves, inexplicable amounts of missed chances from the opposition, who were excellent. They make two mistakes and Real Madrid end up winning 3-1. It's what they do, and I get it, and I get it, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm so glad tiring. It's not me doing this.
It's tiring having to keep trying to analyze it. Logic says that if Real Madrid do not start to improve, they're going to be punished by teams who have more attacking quality and finish their chances better than Stuttgart did here or Real Sociedad did at the weekend. But equally, I can't sit here and genuinely say that because we know that isn't how it works. It's impossible to analyze Real Madrid in games like this. They were second best for 80 minutes and Stuttgart were brilliant. And I want to talk about them in a minute and, you know, give a takeaway about where they're at right now. But I just feel like I'm watching the same game on repeat. And, you know, you listen to the commentary and I think it was someone who said, it might have been Lucy Ward, who said, you know, this is what happens. So many teams feel like they come to the Bernabeu and put in a good performance and walk away with nothing. And I was like, yes, agreed. But this Real Madrid side don't look right. I know they've won. And look, the third goal is a great moment for Endrick, who scores. I mean, look, he shouldn't score. Alexander Nubel pushes it into his own net. It is not the kind of goal that he will want to look back on the goalkeeper. But what a moment for Endrick scoring his first Champions League goal, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Like, all of that, great. But Real Madrid don't look like they have any control in games. There's a great pass from Tchouaméni for the first goal, which is just after the break. But how Stuttgart didn't go in winning, I will never know. And then you just get this period where you're like, well, there it is then. As soon as Real Madrid go 1-0 up, you're like, okay, they'll be fine now. They'll win 2-0. And instead they go back to it and they concede. And you're like, well, that's no more than Stuttgart deserve. And then finally, a bit like you said with Van Dijk and Liverpool earlier, the goal that Stuttgart eventually concede is Modric just chipping the ball into the box from a corner and Antonio Rudiger just rises highest and nods it home. And therefore the game's ended. Stuttgart push everyone forward to try and get an equaliser and end up conceding on the counter. Fine. But it's just so difficult to look at it and think, how can this Real Madrid side go on and be recognised as the best side in Europe again? And yet, we're just starting all over. We're just doing this again.
Yeah, it just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. I mean, I've started to say recently that I'm convinced Mbappe ends up on 40 goals. I feel like what Bellingham said last season about playing off the cuff perhaps becomes something we have to keep remembering even more once we're seeing Vinny and Mbappe starting to swap positions a little bit. And I haven't seen this game, but when I was watching the scores drop, obviously, throughout the game that I was watching, I had an eye on this one because part of me did expect this to be a bit of a blitz tonight. And I thought, you know what, I could see Madrid winning this one 3 or 4-0. So when it suddenly went 1-1 and there's only like 20 minutes left, I was like, oh, that ain't good, because I can see, without even seeing the game, that doesn't feel right to me, because that could quite easily now go the other way. Madrid are going to, they've had pretty fine margins, right, so far this season. Like, usually they've got these 2-0 wins, but they haven't necessarily been that convincing. And yet they've ended this one with a 2-goal margin as well. And it's because they've scored, an 83rd minute goal and what an injury time from Endrick. So you can't analyse it, mate. It's pointless. As I said, Ancelotti doesn't really have a set structure or philosophy to how he wins things. He just wins things. So they are a team that nobody, and I mean this, can analyse properly. Nobody can. And you can't predict things properly because they will slip up at times when they is possibly not expected. But equally, they'll probably win the Champions League. So a really difficult one. But I like the fact that Endrick got that goal. Like he's getting a few goals that are actually really, really important to him in these early stages of his Madrid career.
Yeah, he's also getting important minutes. And I was a bit worried about how many minutes he was actually going to end up getting, especially with the strikers and the wingers rotating. But I think that he will benefit from some of these injuries across the team because he's the one that's going to look to, you know, to come on late in games and to actually try and play on the counter, especially if teams are trying to get back in games against Madrid. There's going to be those opportunities for him. And look, he probably should pass here, but he shoots. And that's the eye for goal he's got at such a young age. And that's so exciting from a Real Madrid perspective. I will say this, though, and I know, and I actually buy into all of what you're saying, and I buy the off-the-cuff thing, and I get it. And I understand that they don't need to be great to win. But I do think that they are deeply, deeply missing Toni Kroos. I think they are really struggling to get a control on games that, yes, there were periods where Madrid felt a bit all over the place last season. Those periods are far more extended than they have been watching them in reasons. I think they're top heavy. At this game, obviously, we saw Lucas Vazquez play right back and Dani Carvajal play centre back. They look incredibly light as centre back. And I think that those are legitimate concerns that there isn't enough depth in the centre-back position for Real Madrid to carry out the season with. If Jesus Vallejo starts playing, then people are going to look to take advantage of him. And look, Dennis Undav is the player that comes up with the goal from Stuttgart at this point. If this is the Stuttgart side of last year, with Valdemar Anton and Hiroki Ito and Sergio Gyarassi up top, I think they win this game. And so the question marks remain from a Real Madrid perspective. Yes, they're off the mark. Yeah, they've ended up with a two-goal margin, all of these things. But all of the questions I have about their opening season performances haven't gone away. It's going to take time. I'm not suggesting that it isn't. But I think Jude Bellingham looks a bit confused as to what his new position is supposed to be. He's no longer allowed to sort of break beyond the striker and make those runs that saw him have such wonderful goal-scoring form last season. There are still these elements between Vinny and Mbappe that they look like they're getting in each other's way. Weirdly, I actually quite like the connection between Rodrigo and Mbappe. And there were moments here where the two of them looked like they were connecting, especially for the goal, which maybe should be cut out by Mittelstadt, but it's a really good ball from Tchouameni. But I do think that Real Madrid have lost some control and they've lost a bit of balance in this team. And whilst I trust Carlo to fix it, for me, this team doesn't look as good as it was last year, and it's going to take something new to turn that around right now.
Yeah, obviously they have had that that problem with connecting all the pieces of their play from the back to the front, and they will have to go into the transfer market again next summer, and I think they'll probably have quite a big one. I think a central midfielder, a centre-back and a full-back are all going to be on the cards, and they're going to sign significant players in those areas too. I think it's unavoidable, to be honest with you, at this point. So it'll be interesting. But also Valverde, what his role is going to be across this season will be interesting too if they continue to have problems in the midfield, because he might have to be that guy that connects the dots.
Sure, but he's not a controller in the same
way.
He's
not, no, but that's kind of what he's having to kind of be.
He's a brilliant footballer and he can do lots and lots of different things well, but I don't think you're asking him to do that. Like, my takeaway is that Real Madrid look a bit like PSG. When in their kind of Galactico era, they look a little bit disconnected. They look very top heavy. They look like the balance isn't there. They haven't spent enough money on defense. And ultimately, I know this sounds ridiculous, but I don't think you can look at them and be like, they're the favorites to win the Champions League this year at this point. But maybe they will be in 3 weeks' time. You know, like I do think this can change quite quickly. I think that right now it would be disingenuous to say that Real Madrid look like the best team in Europe. And I know they don't always.
They never do. That's the thing. But, you know, they never have to. And that's part of the problem for everybody else is that you think that it's a season when there's an opportunity and then it turns out there's not.
Yeah, I mean, look, Sheriff beat them once at the Bernabeu and they still did their bit. So it is what it is, right? But look, just before we go and before we move on, real positives for Stuttgart here. They were bright. They made things happen. They just need to find a little bit of that killer instinct and cut out the mistakes. And look, as I said, a really tough summer for them. They lose their first choice centre-back pairing, one to Dortmund, one to Bayern in Ito and Anton. And then they lose Gyarassi to Dortmund as well, their top scorer from last year. Very, very difficult to replace those players. But Sebi Hernes has stuck around. And I think that's massive. He came out, he was bright. He was really, really on it with their game plan today. They looked like they knew how to get in Madrid's faces. Has it worked out? No. But they're going to face a lot of teams that are worse than this Real Madrid side. They're going to face a lot of teams in this competition that they will look at and think, wow, we've got our one away game at our biggest seed out of the way first time, and we've given a massively good account of ourselves. How do we kick on from here? They haven't been great in the Bundesliga so far, but I do think that there's enough in that team. I think that they've replaced relatively well given the circumstances. I think they're going to give a couple of teams a really, really good game. So I would be optimistic if I was a Stuttgart fan.
Very good, very good. That's what they need after that.
Right. Do you want to move us on to Aston Villa, who won 3-0 in Bern at Young Boys?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was the perfect start to their life in the Champions League. Villa fans would have been relishing this day when their players were lining up and they listened to that Champions League anthem. You know, Villa, don't forget, have European pedigree, but this was a moment they've waited over 40 years for, and it was worth the wait, I reckon. It was probably the perfect opposition, to be honest with you, because Young Boys, turns out, aren't very good. But we'll get onto that in a minute, because the top line is that Youri Tielemans moved for a reason and it is paying off. When he was at Leicester, I remember talking to somebody about what was going wrong for him and what they saw for him. And there was this moment when him and Brendan Rodgers were having issues because Youri Tielemans felt like he was a Champions League footballer and he should be getting a really big transfer and was worthy of it. And Brendan Rodgers, from what I was told at the time, was like, yeah, you're good, but you're not that good. Like, you're not worthy of like that, those big clubs that you are talking about that you're thinking that you're going to end up at. Obviously, he ends up at Aston Villa, which, fair enough, isn't a Liverpool or a Man City or whatever else. But he made the right move because he's ended up in the Champions League and he's made his bow in the Champions League and he's got the first goal and he's also come away with an assist and he's also come away with a Man of the Match award. So Youri Tielemans is absolutely loving life today because he feels like his moment has come. This is what he's waited a long time for. Now, in the early stages of this game, there was a bit of concern, like, Villa were playing in a way where McGinn and Ramsey kind of tucked in and looks like Young Boys were going to make some progress with their fullbacks. It took Villa a little while to get back in the game. They couldn't progress the ball. They were keeping it at the back a lot and didn't seem to know how to get it forward. And then suddenly on like the 25th minute or something, Emi Martinez just decides to throw a 60-yard pass forwards. And suddenly it ends with McGinn trying to stick one in pretty much the top corner. It didn't work out quite, but suddenly they'd mixed things up. Young Boys had been thrown onto the back foot and Aston Villa actually had a bit of life about them.
Had they got used to the bouncy ball at the pitch at that point?
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. Maybe it was the bouncy pitch, yeah, because they're basically playing on a playground. But ultimately, it gave them a bit more confidence and belief that moment. And within a couple of minutes, Youri Tielemans has got a goal. It's obviously a huge moment for Aston Villa. It's one that they celebrated wildly, and it's right that they do that. But it calmed them down and it set the tone for what was to come. And there was no way back for Young Boys from that moment, partly because Aston Villa did play very well on the night, partly also because Young Boys really aren't very good, it turns out, mate. To talk about the second point, I will talk about the Young Boys defending, which was, I don't know if you've seen this goal yet from Jacob Ramsey.
I have seen it, yeah. It's not great.
The defending is like, honestly, unlike anything you should expect to see in the Champions League. It is so amateur that you won't even see it if me and you pick 10 blokes from the pub and go and have a kickabout. It's that bad. Like, they get stuck in their own box and it just ends up with like basically a tap-in for Ramsey. And then again, massive moment for him, obviously, Villa lad. To get a goal in the Champions League is huge. But Young Boys really didn't help himself there.
No.
So it really made, and the rest of the game, I was looking at thinking, one of the big fears, I guess, about this competition is about whipping boys, is about the fact that the deeper we get into the tournament, that there are going to become more matches actually that are played between meaningless opposition, and that if you're not competing for those upper echelons, then
sure, you could be out. If you finish 24th, you get into a playoff. Yes, it's going to be very difficult to play the team who finished 9th, but you never know with those kind of two-legged playoff games. And look, having spent a lot of time watching the Europa League and the Conference League, right, those playoff rounds are not easy. There's a team dropping down from the Champions League, and yes, obviously they're not in the best form because they've ended up finishing 3rd in their Champions League group or their Europa League group, but they're still expected to go and win those games. And often the jeopardy of those gets in players' heads. So finishing, you know, in those bottom ends of the playoff places isn't the worst thing in the world, I think. And if you know, maybe it's not for young boys in terms of this stadium is not a place that inspires fear, but if you're Red Star Belgrade, Sven Zvezda, or you're Dinamo Zagreb, and you know you've got to bring someone to the Maksimir or the Maracanã in Belgrade, those are opportunities to be like, you ain't going to want to come here and you're not going to want to play on this. And maybe young boys have that with their pitch, but I mean, Villa got used to it pretty quick, right?
Yeah, look, young boys' next two games are Barcelona and Inter Milan. I can guarantee you now they ain't winning either of those two games. So they're three games, three losses, as far as I'm concerned, from what I've seen here.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've had a really bad start in Switzerland. They've been so dominant there for such a long time, right, that it almost feels nuts. But we're talking about a team here that have really dominated the Swiss Super League. This season, they've played 6 and they've won none. So actually at this point, and all of those games have been pretty chaotic, so this is no longer the side that it was last year. And actually it looks like there might be an opportunity for another power to rise, perhaps in Switzerland after such a long period of domination.
Yeah, I will say that they almost scored one of the best goals you've ever seen in your life. Colley, he hit one. It must have been 90 miles an hour. It went just over the bar. I tell you what, it would have been an absolute banger. So slightly disappointed for him that didn't hit the net. The last thing I really want to finish on here for Villa is John Duran versus Ollie Watkins and the stupid disallowed goals. Now, Watkins should have had a goal. Fieldy should have had a goal. It was ruled out. John Duran really thought he should have had a goal.
The Watkins one.
Sorry?
Felt a bit harsh, the Watkins one, the handball that you couldn't really see.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've seen the Duran one, but the handball happens, Onana handballs it like way before. Like the handball, is this like, how far are we going to take play back to look for a handball? This is surely as far as you can go back on a tape to block it. He did handball it, but it was so obvious at the time that should have been given as a free kick in real time. And if it's not, that moment is not significant enough in the build-up that it should stop what then happens however many passes later when Duran scores a brilliant finish. And obviously Duran, he doesn't celebrate quietly, right? He's out there giving it the big one like he is on stage and a showman. He is a showman. But what I'm really interested in, mate, despite the fact that both of these guys had disallowed goals, is that look, Ollie Watkins comes off, Duran comes on, Ollie Watkins has ice on his ankle, right? I don't know, probably a precaution. Watkins didn't seem that concerned. He's kind of just sat there with it up. But I'm like, do you know what? If Duran takes Ollie Watkins' spot, I don't know if he's going to get it straight back because Duran is seriously making a claim for starting in this Villa team. He is really, really living up to the hype that he built himself over the summer. And I'm actually really intrigued as to the moment that he does get his start ahead of Watkins, if it works out. Now, somebody asked us on Patreon the other day, like, is there a world where these two can start together? And I can't see it. But it might be something that Emery's got to try and get his head around at some point if it can work, because otherwise he's going to be left with a headache as to how you keep these two guys happy. It's probably the best problem you could have at a football club is two guys. If it's still a problem, yeah, because they've got egos and they've got expectations and they want to be out there eating up those big moments. To be honest, Watkins isn't eating up those big moments at the moment. I'm not saying he's playing badly, but he dragged another one wide in this game that he probably should have scored. And Duran, as we know, will fancy that he will score any chance that comes his way. And I think the pressure's starting to build here for him to get the nod. So yeah, look, a 3-0 win. Onana gets on the score sheet as well. Again, he moved to Aston Villa because he wanted not just regular football, but Champions League football.
Loves goals now, apparently. Never loves goals.
Yeah, loves goals. You know, Arsenal, there was some real talk at one point about him going there. It was made pretty clear to him that he wouldn't be guaranteed games if that was the move that both parties looked to pursue. And he didn't really like that, from what I understand. He wanted a pretty much a promise of game time. And, well, I don't think anyone can actually give you that. Villa was as close as he could get to in terms of that regularity of play and playing at this level. And he's doing really well.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Nice to see some of those players who are in that rotation start to rear their head for Villa. As you say, a good problem for Emery to have. Just want to finish by talking quickly about Juventus, who won 3-1 against PSV. Big moment for this for Juve, because obviously there is this spell where you go through this kind of, oh, look, you have two games where you don't score a goal. And after a really good start, people are starting to grumble a little bit. And then Kenan Yildiz does this, right? So Kenan Yildiz has spoken about the fact when he got the 10 shirt for Juventus, he spoke about the fact that his hero is Alessandro Del Piero, right?
Yeah.
Well, tonight he scored a goal that Alessandro Del Piero would have been very, very proud of.
It's he couldn't have scored it, Jack. He couldn't have scored it.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm not going to sit here and talk about Del P like that. But, I mean, look, that's how you put paid to that kind of goal drought, and you start your club off on an absolute flight. And just an amazing night. Obviously, he became Juve's youngest scorer in the Champions League. He was incredible. And what I loved about him tonight was the way that he drifted off his wing and the way that Teun Koopmeiners, who, you know, has come into this side, as there's been a couple of question marks about quite where he fits. If Yildiz is going to play as a 10, it's a position that Teun Koopmeiners took up quite a lot last season for Atalanta. We know that there's been reinforcements deeper in the midfield as well, and some more players playing really, really well for Juve there. We've seen that Douglas Luiz has obviously done a really good job, and Locatelli's come in there. We've got Kevin Turam in there. Weston McKennie comes in tonight, scores a goal, plays brilliantly, I thought. So lots of questions about where Koopmeiners would fit in backwards. The way that he drifted out to the wing in order to allow Yildiz to cut inside and be the best version of himself, I think is a massive string to his bow and a massive reason why this might work from a Juve perspective, from trying to get whoever's in the 10. Koopmeiners played a lot of different roles tonight, and that really did allow Yildiz the freedom to do the things that he needed to do. But yeah, I think this was almost as perfect a night as you could ask for if you were Juve, right? McKennie scores in his first start of the season. Nico Gonzalez scores his first goal for the club. Yildiz, incredibly entertaining and incredibly effective. It would have been lovely for Vlahovic to score, I imagine, from his perspective. But his hold-up play was immense. He created a ton. The assist for Nico is so good. The attack functioned with him as the linchpin. And, you know, as Juve was starting to be questioned about whether they could make this work in an attacking sense, they pull out a performance like this. I mean, obviously they concede late on, and that would have been ideal. The first goal they've conceded this season to keep that clean sheet. But on the whole, this is about as good as you can ask for if you're Juve. And to be honest, I was pretty disappointed with PSV. I really thought they were going to give a better account of themselves. I thought that they would look at this and see the kind of, not problems, but maybe festering kind of frustrations with Juve over the last couple of games. Be like, this is a real opportunity to go out and hurt them. A very young back four, and it got run around a little bit. Mateo Dams on our left back, I thought, had a torrid time against Nico Gonzalez. Ryan Flamingo's a defensive midfielder really by trade. Him being pushed into the back line didn't really work. Richie Ledesma took a bit of a beating at right back as well. It didn't really work, I didn't think. And Tillman playing out on the left rather in his preferred sort of 10 slot wasn't great either. Luke de Jong pretty ineffective. It felt like Juve were in the ascendancy from pretty much minute 10. They were, you know, PSV started okay, but from the moment that Juve started to get a hold on this, Di Gregorio made a decent save early on. It then just felt like they'd completely assumed control of it. And look, we've spoke about this already, but Juve being able to take control of games and assert themselves, put themselves on the front foot, is already such a change from what we saw from Allegri last season. And if they can put performances like this together on a regular basis, and we know there's going to need to be rotations because there's so much talent in this squad, so much talent in this midfield, as I just spoke about, but Tim Weah coming off the bench doing really well, Fagioli as well coming off the bench and doing well. We know that there's players in here that are trying to make a name for themselves, someone like Juan Cabal, missed out. Cambiasso played at left back this time. Kalulu played at right back. There's loads of questions about who plays where. But I think that what we do know is that Motta's system is starting to take hold. Juve look like they have an identity and a style again. And the way that the front four operated together tonight, Koopmeiners, Yildiz, Vlahovic and Gonzalez, absolutely brilliant. Their dovetailing was sensational. I thought the Western did really well dropping into that and being able to provide a platform. Did really well defensively. Second half was very good going forward in the first. Locatelli holding it all together. I was very, very impressed with Juve tonight. I thought that this was one of, obviously the first couple of performances were good, but this felt like the most complete performance that we've seen from them so far. And even when in the second half where they were able to kind of step off the gas a little bit and be like, okay, come at us if you want. They defended really, really heroically until the very, very end. So it really did look like a Juve side that are going places. And after two disappointing results, a really good way to bounce back, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, that's promising to hear from a Juve's perspective. I guess the intrigue will now come as to what is the real version of Juventus. Obviously, they're very early into this Motta era. Like, there's many teams right now that are being built up, right? There's been managerial changes at other clubs too. But Juve's feels like one that has a particular eye on it because you're wondering how they do change from one style to another. They start off the season with 2-3-0 wins, then suddenly they're in two goalless draws, and now suddenly they go into a Champions League game against a decent Champions League opponent, and they win 3-1. So I guess it's like, well, the real version of Juventus, please stand up now. You've got Napoli coming up at the weekend, and it's like, okay, this is what we want to see. Napoli, Genoa, who's after that? Leipzig they've got in the Champions League. So let's see some consistency now in performance. If not, you'd have to win every game. It's impossible, obviously, but let's just see exactly what we're about and make sure that we've got this regular goal threat.
Yeah, I mean, look, on tonight's evidence, I think it's going to be very hard to drop any of those front four. 8, 9, 10, 11, Koopmeiners, Vlahovic, Yildiz, Gonzalez. Oh, I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the weeks to come. Who plays behind them? I think that will chop and change. But I imagine that as we start to see Juventus come into themselves a bit more, those are going to be the front four because of the way that they interacted tonight and what we saw from them. The goals will come for Vlahovic. We saw goals from either side, Koopmeiners creating, and that ability to sort of switch positions, all of that really, really nice tonight. So shouts out to Juve.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Nice one.
Alrighty. And with that, I think it's probably time that we call this a day. So that is everything from today's Champions
from day
League
one.
Takeaway. There you go. Dean and I will be back on Thursday to look at days 2 and 3. We probably won't cover every game, but we
can't
will
cover every game. That would be for hours.
Talking points. Yeah, we would be here for hours. Look at all the big talking points from across those games and we'll come to you on Thursday night with them on this same feed. But for now, all that's left for me to do is say thank you very, very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Champions League Takeaway, the first of the season on Ranks FC. We'll see you all very shortly, gang. Take it easy. Peace.